at present, producing food requires only a small percentage of the total energy this country expends. And yet, awareness of the energy crisis has prompted a review of our energy priorities. How our vital agricultural sector can best use available energy supplies concerns Dr. Charles Reinert of the Southwest Minnesota State College Physics Department. Dr. Reinert was a member of the Governor's Energy Policy Task Force for the state of Minnesota. In a recent conversation, Dr. Reinert spoke about energy and agriculture.
Looking at all of the sources that I have found to date, I think you can probably count the major studies on energy on the fingers of one hand, and you probably won't count very much higher than about three. A study was done by Mike Perlman out of the University of California at Chico. That's about 2 years old, I think. A study also came out of Cornell by Pimentel and Associates. I think that was published in Science in about November of 1973 or thereabouts. There are about perhaps one or two more studies whose names I don't recall, but that's just about the sum total of it. As a matter of fact, just before I came down to for the interview, I was talking to a Dr. Klepper down at Washington University at St. Louis. I'd heard in a roundabout fashion that Barry Commoner's group at Washington University had received an NSF grant.
NSF being the National Science Foundation.
That's correct, right, for looking at the whole energy picture in agriculture. And in fact, they had. They're into it about 6 months or so now. But apparently one of the things that made it somewhat easier for Commoner's group to get the money for the work is that they had heard that NSF was really having a bad time of it from Congress just because so little was known on the use of energy in agriculture. So as of about 2 years ago, there was essentially nothing known, I think, on energy and agriculture, at least very, very little. So now I think the work is beginning to be done, but still the data is a little bit scanty as far as I'm concerned. The interesting aspect, of course, about energy and agriculture is that if you're worried about the total use of energy, it may be that agriculture is not the first place that you might start looking to think about making cuts. One of the first things that you find is that the total amount of energy used in agriculture per se is something like, I think, about 3% of the total national use of energy. So it's not like 50%. It's not really a very large quantity. On the other hand, if you begin to take a detailed look at the numbers, you find that apparently the energy efficiency has been dropping steadily, that we're using more energy in general in agriculture and getting less out compared to what we put in. And that's not a very good trend. I suspect it's happening in other phases of industry as well. But in these days of, I think, warranted concern about energy use, I think it's worthwhile taking a careful look at what data is available to see what perhaps can be done. One of the things I think that farmers need to be concerned about as far as energy use is concerned is perhaps one, are they going to have the energy that they need? And of course, we almost saw problems about a year and a half ago with the lack of energy for crop drying in the fall. Luckily enough, it was a nice warm fall. Nature collaborated and we didn't have too many problems, but it could have been, I think, very bad. The other aspect, I think, is not only the availability, but, of course, the price of energy. And I think it behooves a farmer to know as well as he can which of the inputs to his farming operation are very energy intensive so that he will know which of those inputs is most likely to go up in cost, or at least by the biggest factor. So I think you have to be watchful of what the inputs are and expect some price increases in some areas, and of course many of these have already occurred.
Would you say then, as perhaps the greatest input into most farmers' economic considerations would be the cost of nitrogen?
Well, if you take a look at the data, and Pimentel brought this out very nicely, it looks as though if you compare the energy inputs, say in 1945, just after the war, to the energy inputs in, say, 1970, there have been about four major increases. One, of course, has been for crop drying. Fewer farmers, for example, are storing their corn in the round cribs, and more of them are using a picker sheller. And, of course, when you do that, then you almost have to use crop drying techniques. Of course, the use of electricity has also gone up rather substantially and, of course, has made farming a whole lot more comfortable because of it. The use of nitrogen has gone up, of course, tremendously. I think the consumption in about 1945 was almost nil, and this has risen now to about 112 pounds per acre for corn production in 1970. And on top of that, then there has been some increase in the energy used in machinery, both in gasoline and, of course, in the energy that goes into the actual construction itself. So I think those four areas, crop drying, electricity, nitrogen, and machinery, are probably the major areas where there's been a fairly sizable input of energy in the last 25 years or so. And I think, in fairness, those are going to be the areas that are going to increase the most in price. We've already seen a substantial increase in the price of nitrogen and in the price of machinery. NSP, of course, is pushing for increases in the price of electricity, and fuel oil, of course, has gone up for crop drying as well. There are some thoughts now, of course, about using solar energy for crop drying, and I think that's a very promising possibility to look into.
It's interesting that these costs have gone up, and the thing that intrigues me is the relationship between the amount of energy that's used and the amount of energy that is produced in the crops.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Pimentel, again, did some work on this, as did Perlman, and they reached, I think, somewhat different conclusions, and I'm not yet sure that I understand the difference between their conclusions. Perlman was, I think, the first one, or one of the first people, to take a careful look at what you get compared to what you pay for as far as energy is concerned. And Perlman found, looking at the overall energy inputs and outputs of agriculture, for agriculture as a whole in this country, found that for every unit of energy you get out, for example, a kilocalorie of food energy, you put in something like 5 kilocalories. So you have a 5-to-1 energy diseconomy in the production. Steinhardt, in his book Energy Sources, Use, and Role in Human Affairs, which I'm using as a text for my own energy course, finds something very similar in general. Pimentel just took a look at the energy inputs and outputs for corn, and just based on that particular crop, found that you do get about twice as much energy out as you put in for corn by itself, including machinery, fertilizer, fuel, and all the rest. He did find, however, that in 1945, we were getting nearly 3 times the energy out that we put in for corn. And in 1970, this had dropped to almost 2. So again, you see a kind of point of diminishing returns, I think. Some authors have argued that we're not likely to push the efficiency of corn production much higher, that we're sooner or later, and perhaps rather soon, going to bump into the limits of photosynthesis, and have expressed, I think, some grave doubts that we'll be able to really redesign that process to make it much more efficient than it is. So it looks as though the output for what you get, what you pay for compared to what you get, I suppose, has gotten worse in the last 25 years. Again, I think, as it has for many other industries.
And essentially, the reason for this being that just in the form of nitrogen and the additional fuels that are being used, the input has increased in relationship to the output.
That's correct, I think. Of course, one of the most efficient ways to utilize energy seems to be to feed a man. And if one takes a look at the Chinese wet rice agriculture, as Perlman has pointed out, their return for each invested unit of energy seems to be about 50-to-1 for every unit of human energy, kilocalories that are put into the system. They extract about 50. So part of the difference, I think, has come from a reduction in the amount of hand labor, of human labor, in a farming operation. And I think part of it has also come from beginning to reach the point of diminishing returns as far as the application of nitrogen and the application of farm machinery are concerned.
This raises some interesting questions. For many years, it's probably been the goal of a number of people to free themselves from the drudgery of hand labor, and certainly farmers have benefited from putting machinery to use over the past 30 years. Mm-hmm. And
what kinds of problems this is going to present, and trying to persuade people that they're going to have to go, perhaps going to have to go back to more toil with their hands again in their agricultural operations.
Yeah, I sense the problem there. And I think one has to admit that whether you talk about agriculture or any other aspect of human life, at least up to a certain point, you seem to be far better off, at least from a standard of living approach and perhaps from a quality of life approach, you seem to be far better off by increasing your energy consumption, at least up to a certain point. Beyond that point, then it's not quite so clear what happens to the quality of life. The standard of living seems to continue to increase. I guess the way that I would perhaps try to answer that is to say that I frankly don't want to go back to picking corn by hand any more than anyone else does, and that maybe if we look in some directions for specific economies, I think we can find some without having to go back to the drudgery that I think every farmer was involved in, say, 25 or 30 years ago. I remember the corn picking by hand myself, although I was small at the time, and it was a lot of hard work, and I don't think we could really push anybody back in that direction except under the most dire circumstances, and I guess I really wouldn't want to.
What are some of these areas that you've looked at and feel that could be cut back in?
Okay. Again, most of what I say is in a sense a repetition of what other people have found. We haven't done any original research here on agricultural energy. Basically, what Pimentel has suggested is that there may be two or three areas where one might gain. One area, of course, is in the use of nitrogen, and they suggest the alternative of, number one, manures. And I think perhaps that manures are already being used fairly efficiently in Minnesota, but evidently not in the country as a whole. The large feedlot operations, say, in the Colorado area, I suspect waste much more manure than ever comes back onto the land. But basically, Pimentel has suggested that manures be utilized more efficiently, and has also suggested that the planting of legumes be reinstituted to cut down on the need for nitrogen. Now, he's gone through the numbers for this, and what he finds, in fact, is that the use of manures is slightly less energy intensive than the use of commercial nitrogen when you include the necessary energy cost for hauling it out to the field and that sort of thing. It comes out slightly better. I suppose the figure is about 20% better or thereabouts. He does, of course, find that the use of legumes for nitrogen incorporation is substantially more efficient, at least from an energy standpoint. It seems to me that it's perhaps 10 to 1 or thereabouts. There's practically no energy involved in planting the legume, and subsequently, of course, you do have to plow it up, but that energy input seems to be fairly small. Now, of course, against that, you have to balance the fact that people don't yet eat much alfalfa. They don't like sweet clover at all. So you have to worry, I think, about the total crop production, particularly in these days where we seem to have gone almost immediately from an energy crisis to a food crisis. So I'm not quite sure just what would happen in the way of going back to a crop rotation, which Pimentel suggests, and specifically of trying to go back to legumes, which he also suggests. It may be that some interseeding or interplanting techniques may be of value. In talking to a farmer in central Minnesota a couple of years ago, he mentioned that in the past they had interplanted such crops as sweet clover and alfalfa right in with the corn. When the corn was high enough to get a good start, then they would come along with the seeding of alfalfa, and they did manage to grow the two crops simultaneously. Now, you may have to be kind of clever and a bit tricky to do that, but this is one possibility then for incorporating nitrogen, say, for the following year's crop. Now, of course, if you have substantial use of herbicides, then this kind of kills that possibility too. Alfalfa is very sensitive to herbicides. So I think there are some problems that have to be worked out there, but I think one can push the use of nitrogen down by rotation techniques, legumes, and manures.
You're suggesting, in other words, a move away from more specialized farming and back to more variety in the crops planted and maintaining livestock, perhaps in cases where a farmer has not had any livestock, he's stuck pretty much with planting a particular crop or maybe two crops.
I guess my feeling tends to be that a push back in that direction would be less energy intensive. I don't know that I could nail those numbers down, but that's my feeling, I think. There are some interesting little side benefits that begin to come in such an operation. I was trying to find this morning the reprint of a paper that has come out of the ARS, the Agricultural Research Station at Morris, and I saw an account of this in the newspaper about last spring, I think, concerning some studies that were done with manure applications to corn plots. And what was found was very interesting. Of course, it did seem to aid the crops, but more than that, it apparently also made the tillage of the crops easier. It made the plowing easier. And the other interesting thing that happened with manure applications is that for some reason, which this particular scientist did not understand, it also reduced the weed problem. So in the back of my mind, I guess I have the suspicion that if we would begin to push things a bit more in the direction of what I would want to call more careful husbandry and perhaps being a somewhat better steward of the soil, we might find side benefits, such as, for example, somewhat easier tillage of the soil, such as, for example, somewhat less weed problem. I think that a lot of the agricultural research in this state and other states has kind of tended to leave weed control to the herbicides, has kind of tended to leave nitrogen incorporation to synthetic nitrogen because it was very cheap for a long time. And therefore, of course, they saw no reason to do work on it. Now I think they may have to change their priorities and begin to do work on incorporation of nitrogen with legumes, perhaps hunt for more efficient soil bacteria to do the job, and in general to look more carefully at the whole energy picture.
This is perhaps then also eliminating a fairly significant cost for the farmer if you're talking about cutting back on certain inputs such as pesticides and herbicides.
Well, I think so, right. There is, of course, a class of farmers who call themselves organic farmers who essentially don't use any herbicides and use very little artificial chemical fertilizer. And these people seem to be getting along. I don't know whether they're making as much money as the traditional farmer, the ordinary farmer, or not. Their inputs, I think, are lower. Their outputs, they claim, are comparable. Frankly, I don't know. I think this is one of the questions also that Commoners Group is going to look into now in the next year or so.
I think this is vital. The main objection to this type of farming has been, over the past few years, I think, a fear that yields would decrease without the technological tools. And I have also talked to some of these farmers you're talking about, and they indicate that their yields are, after an initial 3 to 5 year period, their yields return to where they were before they left off with using the chemicals.
Right. Yeah, that's what they seem to tell me. I frankly am not an organic farmer myself, and I don't farm, although I have a small farm. But that's the sort of thing that these people say, and I guess I look forward to Commoners' work to see whether, in fact, this really happens. There's been a little bit of work by the university and other agencies throughout the country on this aspect, but I'm afraid I must argue that some of it is pretty poor, and look forward to some really good work on it. But they certainly seem to argue, at any rate, that their weed problems are no worse, that their yields are comparable. They even argue that their animal health is better, and perhaps there may be some side benefits that we've overlooked. As I mentioned in this work at Morris, this particular scientist found that his weed problem disappeared only by incorporating manure into the soil, and that would be the last thing that I would ordinarily expect, but it did happen.
I think another consideration is the food value number of these people who work with the low energy input type of farming suggest that the protein content of their crops is comparably higher than other farmers' products. And I don't think this has been substantiated, though.
No, I frankly don't know of any work that's been done that indicates that one is very much higher than the other. I haven't seen very much. Well, no, I'll take that back. I do. I have one reference which comes out of the journal Chemistry for October 1973, and I was going to mention this today. Basically, the article from Chemistry describes, it's a general survey article entitled Return to Organic Farming, and it describes in particular a study which was done in England, conducted in England, as it says, over the past 35 years. I think it began in about 1938. It's called the Holly Experiment, and basically they set up three types of farms, an organic section on which animals were raised, a mixed section with animals, and a mixed section without animals, which they called the stockless section, and basically treated one of them in a kind of fully organic way, using apparently a minimum of any kind of chemical additions, and with an emphasis on manures and such things. One of the other plots was a strictly chemical approach, and apparently the third one was a kind of control. And basically what they found over the 35 years, and quoting from the section, cows in each section were fed the crops growing on their own respective sections. So this is an interesting aspect, in fact, of this whole research picture on organic farming. The organic farmers get rather upset if one simply looks at the yield from the field in terms of bushels per acre, and if you don't go the next step and actually feed the yield to livestock to see what the food value really is. At any rate, according to this article, they emphasize that organically fed cows gave more milk on 10 to 15% less feed than cows in the mixed section. Genetic differences were ruled out, et cetera, and this seems to be substantiated then by the controls on the plot. They also mentioned something that's very interesting from the energy aspect, and I didn't mean to dwell on the issues here, but it says that the organic farms were more easily worked. Amounts of gasoline, which the tractors consumed in plowing, were almost half of those needed for stockless fields. And I think this correlates with, again, many reports that I've had from students of farmers, from farmers themselves, who talk about the land of their neighbors becoming gradually more difficult to plow year after year. And this seems to be occurring. But occasionally you'll find a student whose father uses lots of manure, and he says, well, gee, we really don't have any problems like that. Our soil is always easy to plow. So there may be some side benefits from the use of animal manures, which come in the way of energy, which come in reduction of soil erosion, which I think was also found in Morris, at least as I recall. Then in terms of the amount of energy that has to be used to till the fields.
So you're saying then that using more manure creates an environment that is better for the bacteria that are working in the soil, perhaps, and would make plowing easier, and also require less fuel for the tractors.
It seems at least to make plowing easier and to require less fuel. And exactly what it does on a microbiological level, I'm not really sure. Of course, the manure does furnish, I think, an easily assimilable food for bacteria. I'm not a microbiologist and don't really know, but that's my understanding, that it's very easy for their digestion, and it does seem to add to their activity in some way. I'd like to mention one other aspect, too. The reason that I suppose I originally became interested in the energy use in society in general and in agriculture in particular, of course, is partly because of my background as a physicist. Physicists are supposed to know all about energy, and they thought they did until the energy crisis came, and then they found they didn't really know very much of anything. But basically, I was a member for about a year on an energy policy task force for the state of Minnesota. And we spent, I think, some 40 meetings and hundreds of hours really looking at the total use of energy, its production, its use, the prices, et cetera, in the state. And we made some recommendations as a consequence on energy use and transportation and the home and such things, which I don't think I would like to go into now. But we also made some comments on energy use in agriculture and did suggest such things as use of manures and rotation and such things. Out of that discussion, which subsequently led then to some discussion with the Department of Agriculture and the University of Minnesota, we obtained some very interesting energy figures, which I might just quote for you here. If one looks at the production of farm crops totally in terms of their energy value, it's kind of interesting to see just how the land lays. If we're talking now simply about carbohydrates and not about protein, of course you need both, but if one talks about strictly carbohydrates, it turns out that if you consider, say, the four major crops which are raised in Minnesota, say wheat, alfalfa, corn, and soybeans, the crop which comes out on top in terms of net energy yield per acre turns out to be alfalfa. Alfalfa, of course, does not ordinarily require any nitrogen incorporation at all. It makes its own nitrogen, and in fact, it also produces nitrogen. Consequently, the figures that I've computed here suggest that while wheat will give you a return of only about 2.5 million kilocalories per acre, corn gives you something like 4.8 million kilocalories per acre, alfalfa comes in at around 5.6 million kilocalories per acre. So if you're interested in nothing more than energy production, and of course carbohydrates are a part of what keeps us going, maybe it would help if people began to learn to eat alfalfa. And I think some work, in fact, is going on in that direction.
Would you say then there might be some research done working with alfalfa to make it into a form that would be more palatable, or would this consume
right.
so much energy that it would make up the advantages that might possibly be gained?
Well, of course, you always have some goods and bads no matter what you do, and I think one just has to wait and see how it comes out. But right now, alfalfa looks like a really good crop to raise as far as carbohydrates are concerned. Whether you can talk people into eating it, of course, and make sure that they get the proper balance of amino acids is another question. But strictly from the energy point of view, alfalfa is really rather good.
Have you yourself tried eating alfalfa?
I think I've eaten some sprouted alfalfa seeds or something like that at a conference, but that's about as far as I've gone too.
In looking at the energy inputs into the cost of raising crops, we have to take labor into account too. Perhaps there's more involved to it than just the work that the farmer himself puts in.
One of the things that agricultural people, I think, boast about occasionally is what they call the terribly high efficiency of the American family farmer. And I'm not quite sure exactly how this is calculated, but I suppose it's something like dividing the total number of people in the country by the total number of farmers. And if you do that, I think you get a figure that's of the order of perhaps 50 to 1. And consequently, the popular claim is something to the effect that one farmer produces enough feed to feed 50 people. Well, that's true in a way, although on the other hand, it's really not true. I guess somehow I think of that in the same way as saying that the chairman of the board of General Motors produces enough cars to take care of the needs of some 30 million people. In other words, I think you have to talk not about one man who may be out there on the farm actually doing the work, but you also have to talk about a great many people who are helping him do his work, whether they are constructing the tractor, whether they are hauling him fuel, whether they are, say, processing the food that he actually produces, manufacturing his fertilizer, manufacturing the other farm machinery that he uses. I think these are all people who are intimately involved in the whole production process, whether or not they ever set foot on a farm. And I think if you include those types of people, it may come down closer to perhaps one farmer producing enough food for perhaps 10 or 15 people. It's certainly not 50. It's 50 if you consider only the people who get their hands dirty, so to speak. But on the overall basis, I think that's not the right way to think about it. Of course, if they talk about the productivity in terms of energy efficiency, then of course that has been decreasing, as I mentioned, from something like 3 to 1 for corn to something like 2 to 1. And apparently, if you consider agriculture in general, then it goes the opposite way, and you have a real diseconomy for food production. So I think we have to be somewhat careful when we talk about the overall efficiency of the family farmer. I suppose the other thing that bothers me when people talk about that is that I'm tempted to say, well, yeah, maybe that's true, but what that means to me is that my own little small town where I have to buy my supplies has decreased in population as a consequence. So I would argue that perhaps my quality of life has gone down just because there aren't as many farmers around, as many people on the land to keep up the small towns. That's another issue, I think, but deserves some looking at.
That does raise an interesting question, and that is, do you foresee a trend toward an out-migration from urban areas back to rural areas again, and perhaps a more human labor-intensive form of farming?
Well, if I had to bet on one direction or the other, I suppose I might bet $5 or $10 that might happen, right? As a matter of fact, going home last night, I happened to hear an excerpt from the speech of, I think it was Dr. Philip Raup of the university. I didn't hear the first part of it, so I'm not sure. At any rate, one of the comments that this person was making was concerning the tremendous investment now, which is necessary to operate what is called a family farm, something of the order of, I suppose, 300 to 500 or 600 acres. And he made the comment that even under the best financial conditions, with reasonable interest rates and with very good luck, no grasshoppers, no plague, no nothing like that, a couple starting up in farming just could not make it. The interest alone would be enough to kill you, almost. You're talking of the order, I suppose, of somewhere near $500,000 investment for two people starting out to try to make their living from farming. He was, I think, suggesting some restructuring of the tax rates and the whole process of transferring a farm from, say, father to son. But it may be that the cost of farmland by itself will have some tendency maybe to begin to break up the large farms into smaller ones, or maybe it'll go the other way and we'll find that the only operators of farms will tend to be Shell Oil and Dow Chemical and the larger corporations, who then presumably would have the capital to do the job. Some other things are happening in Canada. I was up in Winnipeg a couple of months ago and talked to some of the Department of Agriculture people there. And they have some very interesting programs. I think one program involves making it easier for a farmer to continue operating his land, even if he doesn't seem to know how. If a farmer just doesn't seem to be making a go on his land, perhaps because he's not using the proper techniques, he can then have the option of selling his farm to the government. They will then come in and let him rent the farm and bring in all kinds of technical experts, hopefully, to help him to do a better job of farming. And then at some later point, if he wants to buy the farm back again, this is made possible. Somehow I have the feeling that perhaps the state government or perhaps the federal government should try to push this whole effort of keeping people onto the farms. I think it's pretty clear we don't need them in the cities. We have plenty there. I think we have a real scarcity out here. I also have the feeling, frankly, that if we had smaller farms, we might see some more careful husbandry of the soil. Having lived in southwestern Minnesota for essentially all of my life, of course, I and probably you are well familiar with the siltation in the lakes, and the fact that one does see a lot of dirty snow in the wintertime just because of the fall plowing. And one sees in general, it seems to me, a kind of lack of care for the soil. And if we consider that the whole nation's health and its well-being and its very existence really go back to the topsoil, maybe we would do well to try to err on the side of being too careful with the soil rather than perhaps not being careful enough. And for me, anyway, to a great extent, this goes back to, of course, number one, education, but goes back also perhaps to smaller farms. I do not see how one man can carefully manage, say, 1,000 acres and do a really good job on it to be a really good husbandman of the soil. I guess I don't understand how that can happen, and I really don't think it is happening.
Would you say then that you believe that a family farm... In a family farm situation, the person operating the farm is going to take better care of the soil than, say, in a corporate situation?
I would definitely think so, right. I think this is, I guess I don't know whether I could point to a lot of studies that say this, but somehow I feel this would be the case, right? Again, it goes back to an individual farmer taking the time to climb down off his tractor, if need be, pick up a rock and put it in his rock collector. Whereas I'm afraid if an employee of a large corporation were responsible for the operation, that rock might just end up going right through the combine that fall. Somehow I feel that if a man has his own control of his own land and has sufficient land to make a good living, but not so much that he can't take good care of it, that I think he'll take better care of it than an employee. This is my feeling, and I have a feeling that many other people feel this way too.
In the past, the United States has proudly pointed to its method of farming when talking to developing countries and has said, hey, we're going to help you out and you can produce enough food to feed your people if you do things the way we're doing them. We'll give you the technology. Now there have been second thoughts about this.
That's right. Again, going back to the study of pimento and co-workers in science, they made a very simple calculation of this and basically asked the question, if we used what is now called Green Revolution agriculture, which I guess I interpret as basically the type of agriculture we have in, say, southwestern Minnesota, if this type of agriculture were used to feed all of the people of the world a minimum calorie diet, and I think the figure they were talking about was roughly 2,000 to perhaps 2,500 calories per day, kilocalories, and if all of the petroleum resources of the world were used to furnish the necessary fuel for this type of agriculture, then according to their calculations, the entire world petroleum resources would last something like 24 years. That means to me that we simply can't begin to try to feed the world, and the world cannot begin to try to feed itself with the type of Green Revolution agriculture that has been so well developed in this country. Apparently, it simply will not work unless we somehow find a very abundant and very cheap source of energy, and I'm not quite sure where that's going to come from. So, frankly, I'm beginning to have more and more respect for the people of Communist China, the PRC, who seem to be able to feed themselves. They don't seem to be starving. They seem to be highly efficient as far as the energy, the food energy production is concerned. Of course, it's mostly with hand labor, and we might not want to go back to that. But they are not starving, and they seem to be doing a good job of caring for their people.
Professor Reinert, you seem to look favorably upon those farmers who are using the so-called low energy input methods of farming. What would you tell a farmer who has questions about the methods that he is using in his farming right now, who might have doubts about the amount of energy that he is putting into his farming operation?
I guess that I would, number one, want to sit him down and give him a feeling for the energy inputs into the operation. And again, of course, they come in crop drying, electricity, nitrogen, and machinery, by and large. If he wants to learn some other alternative techniques, which may in the long run be beneficial, I think we're not quite sure whether they will be or not. I think we'll learn a good deal from Commodore's work when it's finished in about 2 years. But if he's interested, then the answer becomes, the answer boils down to the fact that it's not all that easy to learn how to farm with low inputs, just as, for that matter, it was not all that easy to learn how to farm using the techniques that he may be using now. Agriculture is a fairly complicated business. There is, an organization which we've set up in southwestern Minnesota, which is attempting to educate farmers as much as possible so that if they want to make a decision to go with other alternatives, at least they will know how to do this. There are not any books on the subject, although one farmer in Iowa is now trying to get one together. But by and large, it comes down, I think, to a matter of their having to learn from each other, to learn from other people who've made a success of this. The university, as far as I know, has nothing on the material on that aspect. There may be a few experiment stations across the country, particularly in the northeastern part of the country, which may have some information. But by and large, it comes down, I think, to understanding what's going on in the soil and understanding what happens when you plow a field or when you chisel plow a field, really knowing what's going on in terms of water absorption and circulation of the necessary oxygen, et cetera. But I guess I do not feel that right now they can get this information from their county agent, because their county agent gets his information from the university, and the university has really not done very much work of this sort. And what they have done, I guess I feel, is not really very good. So I think it's a matter of perhaps searching out other farmers who've been able to make a go of it and learning about their techniques. There are, I think, a few books that one might perhaps start with. I, of course, have grown up on a farm and have some farm background, perhaps some farm knowledge, but I got a good deal out of a small book which was published way back in the 30s by Ed Faulkner, and the name of it is Plowman's Folly. It discusses the whole concept of the moldboard plow. Faulkner had some extreme misgivings about the moldboard plow, didn't like it very much at all for moisture absorption reasons and for decay of organic matter reasons. And I personally learned a great deal from that book. I think there are a few others around, but it may well come down to getting in touch with farmers who are using these techniques, and then the guy can make his own decision whether he wants to go in that direction, try it at least with some fields, or what he wants to do. But I somehow feel that if your agriculture is based on, number one, high inputs, and in addition to your high outputs, that as costs keep going up in every other sector of the economy, they're going to go up at least as fast in agriculture. And it's not clear that one ever gains then by having high prices in the marketplace for selling the grain if your input costs are up tremendously as well. So I guess I keep trying to think in terms of an agriculture which really produces energy, and consequently should have a lower input of energy, rather than an agriculture which may not produce any energy but require energy and has high input as well as the high output. Our particular association is called the Soil Association of Minnesota, and I suppose that if anyone were interested in it, they could write to me, for example, at the college, and I could direct them to the appropriate people. But it's, by and large, seems to be a matter of learning. We've tried to bring in biologists and chemists and geologists and all of the people that we can get our hands on who can possibly help these guys, and to basically help them to understand their own problems. So it's a kind of self-help type of approach, I guess.
You've been listening to Dr. Charles Reinert of the Southwest Minnesota State College Physics Department discuss agriculture and energy. This is Steve Monroe.